Hey, greetings, Internet. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow, not only by learning new things, but by connecting their work to big ideas and overcoming the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. Welcome to episode 183. Let's see how things unfold with Beth Harrington. Beth is an independent producer, director, and writer with a passion for American history and music. In this episode of Getting Work to Work, we talk about what it means to be independent, technology and nostalgia, the economics of filmmaking, how stories affect her as the storyteller, and taking risks and being courageous in later stages of her career. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/183. Well, Beth, welcome to Getting Work to Work. I'm excited to talk today about film, about courage, risk-taking, and how you built a career as an independent filmmaker. And just to start, I love the label independent. And so how has the definition of independent filmmaker shifted and evolved throughout your career?
When I first started... When I first got out of school and was thinking of having a life in the media, there really weren't a lot of independent filmmakers. That wasn't even a thing. You know, there are people like Andy Warhol, and there are people like John Cassavetes, and, you know, there were a handful of direct cinema documentarians, famous ones, but still kind of only a handful. You know, Richard Leacock and people, D.A. Pennybaker and people like that. So it wasn't even something that I thought was possible to be for a very long time. So I didn't really pursue it for many years, although I knew I wanted to be telling stories and I knew I wanted to make that my work. And it wasn't until I think, you know, a few things happened. One is that the technology got a little more accessible. And another thing was that it just became easier to work outside of, you know, big studios and big institutions, which isn't to say that it was real easy, but it was easier. And then, you know, in recent years, and for a while there was the issue of what constitutes an independent film, you know, is Miramax really an independent film company when they've got the resources that they had? You know, that kind of thing. But now I think it's even more of a moniker that, you know, lots of people can claim as their own. You know, it's you get a laptop and you get a camera and you're a filmmaker. That's liberating for a lot of people who want to tell stories. It also has changed the landscape because so many people are doing it. So it's interesting.
It is interesting. And I wonder, you know, where it's headed myself, because it's just like, if everyone has access, if everyone can do it, does it change what film is, or does it make it better? Does it make it worse? I mean, those are some of the questions that I have at times.
Well, I think it makes it trickier for, I mean, there's just so much more stuff, right? I mean, it makes trickier for good stuff to be seen. Because there's just so much of it to filter out. You know, it used to be I would get an independent film magazine and I could read the independent film magazine and pretty much know the names of my contemporaries who are making films. Now I have no, you know, there are just so many people able to do it, which doesn't mean that a lot of it is bad. It just means that there's just that much more of it and it makes it hard for decision makers to figure out, you know, what rises to the top. And that still is kind of, you know, the game, because it's one thing to want to do this and make it an avocation. It's another thing to try to make a living at it. And because there are that many more people able to do it, decision makers don't have to pay as much money for things and they don't, you know, they can kind of wait around for you to finish your film before they have to really put any skin in the game. So that's a very different dynamic.
Interesting. Well, not only like decision makers, but like the audience shifts too, and, totally. And their perception of value. You know, if it's on Netflix, it's valuable.
Right.
It's just like, but is it? You know, so it's like from an audience perspective, it's very interesting at what audiences will support and pay for.
Yeah. And it is interesting. Like, I just had my last film on Netflix. In fact, the contract just wrapped up recently. And so we'll be migrating to another platform. I'm not sure which one, but my distributor is working on that now. Yeah, people go, ooh, you're on Netflix, which, yeah, that's cool. That's very cool. But what does it mean in terms of people's willingness to pay for things? And it's the great disruption. It's happening, you know, across the board, you know, whether it's the cab you're riding in or the music you're downloading or, you know, the films you're watching or,
I always think that there's, on one hand, you know, technology has made it accessible, but then there's nostalgia of technology of the past that has come and gone. And I don't know, I think that seeing that love affair with nostalgia is kind of where a lot of stories seem to be right now, especially, you know, what I'm seeing in Hollywood and just superhero films. And I don't know, there's something about the stories that we're telling that is just embedded in nostalgia.
Yeah, there is a lot of truth to that. It is interesting. I hadn't thought about it quite that way, but certainly there's, you know, I think every generation has those things that they hearken back to, you know, whether it's a kind of music or a film style or, you know, I think a typeface, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff that plays with the tropes of the past and you know, speaks to certain generations of people. I always think it's just interesting to see what stories, you know, it used to be that when you went to a decision maker and said, I want to make X film, you know, mm-hmm. and it's about X. And they would want that film to be able to reach the biggest possible market. You know, you'd have to make an argument that this was going to appeal to, you know, be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. There isn't quite that need anymore, but you do have to know what your niche is, you know, and you really have to be able to make the case that you're going to be able to reach those people. And so, you know, depending on, you know, if when you're looking at nostalgia, for example, who's nostalgia, you know, is it the, is it the, you know, what demographic is it?
Yeah. So
that's so interesting.
For you, what stories captivate you?
Well, I like to tell stories that help us understand the present by looking at the past. So, and I guess that's my nostalgia, although it encompasses centuries. So, but I like telling historical stories. I like showing how we got to where we are now. Mm. And, you know, a lot of that in documentary can be very literal. And in my work that's not quite so documentary oriented, I still play with those ideas of, you know, what happened in the past that informs our present. So I love telling stories that also deal with the diversity of this country. Most of my work is about the United States. Mm-hmm. And most of it is, I try to address untold stories. And often that means telling stories with a really diverse character base, I guess you'd say.
So when you're approaching a story of the past, there's so much to draw from. How do you know when the story's right to bring it to life?
Well, I think I have to believe that there's something really compelling about it. And usually that's just my gut, you know, like if it appeals to me and, you know, it made me go, wow, I didn't know that, then that often means that other people are going to be surprised by it as well. I think that's an important part of what I do, that people need to go, oh my God, I had no idea there were these two Chinese men who lived in John Day and saved the town from a run on the banks and became the most valuable doctors in the area, you know, or I didn't know that Lewis and Clark brought an enslaved man with them across the country. And what was his story? Mm-hmm. Or, hey, I didn't know that the first people to really make it as country music singers included a group with two prominent women in the band. You know, I mean, those things, I think people go, oh, I didn't know that either. Tell me more about that. So that's always an important entree for me. But the other thing, because film is such an expensive medium, is that I have to say, yeah, and I think this bunch of people will like it. I think this bunch of people will care about it and help build an audience for the film as I make it and make sure that I can reach those people as I'm making it, as well as when we've completed the film.
Yeah. You just connected something really important for me, because I think on one hand is the importance of the intuition or the gut of the filmmaker. Mm-hmm. But when you just said, but I think this group of people is going to like this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to connect to them. And while I'm doing it, that's like a 1-2 connector that I hadn't quite put together yet.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, you know, film is one of those art forms that, you know, it's just, even as I say, you don't need the resources you used to need to make a film, to make a really good film, and especially to make a historical film with archival assets in it, like stock, you know, archival footage from a TV show or old paintings or old photographs, all that stuff costs money. So I can't go into my art form, and not to put anyone else down, but I can't go and buy a canvas and some paints. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a much bigger commitment than that, right, financially. Not, you know, which is not to say that an artist can, you know, just sit down and paint without some muse, I know. But it just makes it trickier. There's always this commercial aspect to it that, you know, unless you really don't care and don't want people to see it, you almost always have to factor it in. Like, you know, who cares about this? Who wants to see it? And then from a strictly, you know, financial level, who's going to pay for this? Who's, you know, who's going to shell out money for me to be able to do this? Am I going to be able to get a grant? Am I going to be able to raise money on Kickstarter? You know, whatever it is, you have to feel like you've engaged people early on. So it's always a consideration. And it's something that I learned early on from the old days of filmmaking, where mostly I was writing grants to raise money to make films. You had to make the case to the funder, you know, to the foundation, or, you know, to the entity that was giving money. It's something that's always in the back of my mind.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, it sounds like it served you well to learn to appeal to the funder, because today we don't need to appeal as much getting out of the gate. I mean, we can start making a film right now, theoretically.
That's true. That's true. But as much as I used to moan about, oh, I have to write a grant to try to get money for this, that process did sharpen my thinking. You know, it brought everything into focus. If I have to convince somebody else that there's merit to this story, that's probably a good thing to know before you start filming. You know, I mean, there's a lot of films that are just lying around. They're like, yeah, I don't care about that so much.
Interesting. Can you remember the moment when you knew you wanted to be a filmmaker?
It wasn't so much about film as it was about storytelling. And I think it's always been something in the air in the home I grew up in. My parents were both artists, and my mother was an art teacher, and my father was in advertising. And there was always music and art and, you know, an appreciation for dance and theater. And so that was always part of the atmosphere in the house. And so I never thought I would do something outside of those areas, but I didn't think, like, as a young woman when I was growing up, the idea that I would make a film was just not on the radar screen. So I don't think I thought about it seriously until I was even out of college. You know, like I looked around and didn't see lots of people doing this. And so there weren't that many models to do it. So it took me a while, but I did like writing, and I was a writer for audiovisual companies when I got out of school. And I liked the storytelling, and I'd also done a lot of radio, and my background's also as a musician. So I love music, and I love the stories of musicians and the history of music in this country. And so all those things kind of fed into what ended up being this vocation of being a filmmaker. But there wasn't like a one moment, I don't think. Although there were certainly things that I thought were amazing when I saw them, but it never occurred to me that I would be doing that at the time.
What is one example of an amazing moment that where you're like, wow?
Well, I think an early one was I saw a series called An American Family when I was in high school. And I remember watching it with my father, and it was, in effect, one of the first American reality shows, although it was not called that then. It was a documentary series. And, you know, it was basically looking at one upper-class family in Santa Barbara, California, and how their lives unfolded in a fairly tumultuous political time in the 60s. And I was just completely wowed by that. Like, I couldn't believe that people were allowed to sit around with cameras in this family's house and just film them. And I had never seen anything like that before. And frankly, most Americans had never seen anything like that before. And so it was riveting, and also kind of watching a car wreck too. You know, this family disintegrated by the end of the series. And interestingly, it was on public television, which isn't really known for that kind of series these days. Mm-hmm. But I was just riveted to it. And it just really made me realize the power of documentary to really shake things up, because it also was one of the sons on the show, Lance Loud, was one of the first openly gay people on national television. And that was amazing. And he was very out. And then we watched the couple, the parents in the Loud family, divorce by the end of the series. Wow. So it was just kind of mind-blowing. And I think that was a moment when I went, oh yeah, that's the power of this thing. That's amazing.
So throughout your career, where has your filmmaking journey taken you in terms of places and stories?
Because it's mostly American stories, I've been all over the country. I think I've been in almost every state. A lot of that's been from filmmaking or researching films or showing my films. So I've been all over. I've spent a great deal of time in the South. My last two personal independent films, not ones that I did for public television or anything, but ones that I generated myself, those were largely about music in the South. So I've spent a ton of time in the South, which is kind of funny because I'm a Yankee from Boston. And I'm sort of the last person that people expect to have done those films, but I did. And I also, you know, got to show those films in the South and elsewhere. And that was really instructive. But I've been I've been everywhere. I've been to Alaska. I did a film in the Aleutian Islands that brought me to the Aleutians for months and months at a time. Locally, I've done films about Oregon beer. I've been, you know, all over the state doing that. I've done a thing on, I did a history detectives episode that took me to the Midwest to look into a typewriter that they wanted to know if it was a historic typewriter.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's wacky the places I've been. Worked on a film about Apollo 13 and spent a lot of time in Houston and Mission Control. Wow. You know, I've met astronauts. I met Mr. Rogers. I met Julia Child. I'm hoping in a couple of weeks to be interviewing Penn and Teller for a new thing I'm working on.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, I get to meet all kinds of cool people. I get to listen to really cool stories. You know, it's a great vocation. I'm really lucky to have the access I've had to people. And one of the reasons I do what I do is because I like being given entree into another world that I wouldn't get to go into ordinarily.
So when you're going to these places, you're meeting these people, How does it affect you as the storyteller?
Well, it kind of varies from situation to situation, but I mean, it's all completely enriching. You know, I mean, I'm really lucky. I feel like when I think about like the dialogue that's going on in this country now about, you know, where we're headed as a nation and the future of the democracy and all those things, I feel like I've been allowed a window into something that I don't think most of us get. You know, I get to spend months on end in the South. I get to spend months on end in the Aleutian Islands. I get to spend time in New York hanging out and showing my films. I get to, you know, I feel like I have a better understanding of what the rest of the country looks like. This is such a huge country. Mm-hmm. And we're all in our little bubbles where we live, you know, more and more. That's how most Americans live, with people who look like them and act like them and believe what they believe. Mm-hmm. And you, to be able to talk to people and interview them in a, what I try very hard to be, a very neutral, non-judgmental, you know, open way. Mm-hmm. I get to hear what people have to say about a lot of stuff, you know, and a lot of it's historical, which gives people a chance to talk about beliefs in a way that's not so fraught as present day stuff can be. So.
Yeah. Wow. I'm getting chills just kind of listening to how you're explaining that, because it's just like that experience of life as opposed to absorption of life through media.
Yeah.
Is just, it's powerful.
Yeah. And it's weird, because of course what I am doing is making media and asking people to absorb it that way. Right. But I'm hoping that some piece of what I'm feeling and experiencing rings true for people, and that there's an authenticity, you know, and I try to give things some nuance, you know, you know, I think it's easy, you know, to keep going back to this example of the South. You know, it's easy for certain parts of the country to judge other parts of the country. And I, growing up in New England, you know, in Boston, where I'm from originally, you know, there are stereotypes about the South, just like some people in the South have stereotypes about people in Boston. Mm-hmm. And for me to be there representing myself, sitting with people who may or may not think differently than me, I don't know, you know, until I actually sit down with them. It's just been eye-opening. And I've made some really good friends. We have very little in common politically or maybe socially, but we have a lot of appreciation for certain things that we hold dear, like, you know, certain kinds of music or certain values that are imparted in music. And that's been a cool revelation for me. I mean, that's just made me a wiser person, I guess, you know.
So one of the things that you mentioned in scheduling this interview is the idea of taking risks in later stages of your career. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? What does it look like to take risks later on?
On one level, there probably isn't much risk, right? I've done a ton of stuff, and I've been fortunate to have a lot of it be really well received. And, mm-hmm. you know, if I stopped doing it today, that would be great to look upon and say, wow, that was great. Mm-hmm. But I'm not ready to be done. So
that's great.
But, you know, not by a long shot. So then it becomes, well, is the next thing I do, if it's not good, is that like the death knell of my career? You know, not necessarily, but it might be the death knell of that particular thing. You know, like you don't get to do that again because people didn't really like that. Mm-hmm. There's always that, the feedback, the critical and audience feedback does have a bearing on what you get to continue to do. And so the risk always feels like, oh, if I, you know, screw this up, I don't get to do that again. You know? So for example, I'm working on an episodic thing now. It's not documentary. It's short. It's narrative. And I'm working with actors, which I have done off and on over the years, but I don't get to do all the time. So it's not my comfort zone. It's more of a stretch. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it myself, and I'm directing it, and I'm producing it, and I'm hoping that if people like the episode that I did, the pilot that I am just finishing this week, mm-hmm. that people will want to see more, and people will give me more money to continue doing it. So the risk is people are going to look at it and go, nah, you don't get to do that again, mm-hmm. you know, but nothing ventured, you know, so I'm doing it, and I'm sticking my neck out, and I'm going to a market/festival in a few weeks that's, you know, known for this kind of work, for looking at this kind of work and evaluating this work and pushing it to the next level if people like it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a risk. I'm going to go, and I'm not going to be, you know, a 20 something hipster person. I'm going to be me. And I do feel, you know, the longer I do this, that, you know, there's the judgments that come with people looking at you and perceiving you a certain way. And, you know, it's always been a trick for women, but now I feel like one of the last frontiers might be older women, mm-hmm. you know? So we'll see. That part feels like a risk, but I'm up for it, and I'm excited to try. And I think what we have is really cool. And I'm also comfortable enough with the idea that you can fail. Mm-hmm. You know, that some things are more successful than others, some projects work out better than others, that if I have to walk away from this, then I will, and it'll have been a good experience. And I also feel like as long as the process was good and honest and authentic, then mm-hmm. there's no dishonor in, you know, maybe not having a critically acclaimed project, you know?
Yeah.
So
it sounds like, too, one of the perspectives that you have is, I don't know if you had this early in your career, but it sounds like you've disconnected your craft from your identity to a certain degree.
I've tried. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. I think that's more recently won, frankly. From a long, long time, it was really hard, especially with my last project, The Winding Stream, which, for reasons I now understand, took way, way, way longer than I ever expected. Took over a decade to make a film that I thought was like something I could hit out of the park right away.
Wow.
And it was so humbling to realize that I was so wrong. And yet ultimately right. Like, the film was very well received. It's probably the best received thing I've ever done. But at the time, nobody cared about it or wanted it and wouldn't fund it and were discouraging and told me things like, nobody's interested. And I kept thinking, no, it's not right. And by the way, I was too far along to turn back. You know, it was in a certain place that I couldn't just let it languish. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, people did end up really liking it. But that period, my identity was really, really wrapped up in that film. And it was really unhealthy. It was really, really bad. And there were, you know, more than one year-end evaluation, self-evaluation, where I would be in tears because it was like, oh my God, another year has gone by and I still haven't finished this stupid film. Mm. And that, it wasn't the film's fault, you know, it's circumstances, and it's not for lack of trying on my part, but I got increasingly wrapped up in the idea that I had to finish this film because it said something about me if I didn't. Mm. So I think, you know, now I feel a lot different, partly because I feel a little vindicated that it was worth sticking my neck out. But at the mm-hmm. same time, I also learned the lesson that I can't let that kind of thing happen again, that I can't, I care about my work, but I can't be so invested in it that it just kind of clouds my self-image, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really hard one. It's only in the last 5 years, I think, that I've gotten there. So it took a while.
Well, and I think that's a great kind of illustration of the fact that, you know, in a society where we value immediacy and being able to have instant results, there are just some things in life that just take time in the pressure cooker of life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think with certain fields like media, people expect a certain kind of turnaround. And when people kept saying to me, isn't it done yet? You know, with all good intentions, I'd be like, you know, I felt like stabbing myself in the heart, you know, like, what do you mean? You know, but it's a function of how we understand how media gets made, you know, like there's a news story and somebody buys the rights for the news story. And the next thing you know, it's a mini series or it's a major motion picture, you know, and it gets done within a year. But that's if you've got all the resources in the world. And you know, certain projects like that are really worthwhile and deserve to get made that quickly. And there are other things that are also worthy that for whatever reasons don't. So it is interesting. I mean, it was a very strange ride after Winding Stream got done to realize that, you know, people did like it. It was worth all that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I needed to figure out how to be more protective of myself and understand that there is a separation between me and my work. So.
So what advice would you give to filmmakers and storytellers, both starting out in their career and those who are stuck in a rut?
I would say, I mean, they're very different. I would say for people who are starting out in their career, especially with what I understand about the marketplace now, I would say, you know, I think all of us start out very optimistic and excited and willing to work for very little money to do the thing we love to do. The thing I would caution people about is that are starting out is this the thing? Is this the thing for you? Because if it's the thing, then just go for it. You know, throw yourself into it and do it. Mm-hmm. But don't have any illusions about how lucrative it might be, or, you know, and it could be, you know, I mean, that there are certainly people who do fine, but more and more, you know, when I was a young filmmaker, there were many other avenues to use those skills to also make a living on the side. Those avenues seem to be shifting and closing. And so I would say to filmmakers starting out, make sure it's really the thing for you. Make sure that you just can't not do it, you know? And if you can't not do it, then just go all in. For people who are stuck in a rut, I mean, God, I've been there myself. I don't know what to tell you about that. I thought about it, you know, you'd mentioned this before, and I thought, well, I think it's kind of got to be a Zen thing, right? It's got to be a one foot in front of the other, appreciation of the journey, an understanding that what you think you're getting out of it might not be the thing you finally get out of it. And that's hard because of the way films are expected to get made, you know, that you have to have this vision and you have to be firm about it. And you have to be able to make things work. And you have to be implementing a plan. the opposite of that is, oh, let's just see how things unfold. Right. Mm-hmm. And to keep your sanity, you almost have to default to the latter, you know, on more than one occasion. You know, let's just see how things unfold. I mean, that's what I'm doing with my new thing, The Musicianer. It's like, let's just see how things unfold. I was willing to put in this much work and we've got a nice thing, an episode that we can show people. Now I'm in the let's just see how things unfold period. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to like let go of whatever might happen in the coming months and year or so. So I think when you're stuck in a rut, you've kind of got to push yourself to, I think, you know, for me, shaking some stuff off is good. Mm-hmm. So I took the content that I gleaned from The Winding Stream, which is about the origins of country music, and I applied it to this narrative project about a musician stuck in time. So I was able to salvage stuff from the last project that was so difficult and put it into something that feels fresh to me, mm-hmm. you know, and keeps my interest. And then the other piece of that is the, okay, I've done that thing I said I was going to do. Now I've just got to let go. Yeah. And so I think the rut can be pretty deep, but I think some of it is about realizing you can do all you can do and then stepping back.
Yeah. No, very powerful. Well, and it's interesting too, because, you know, as I wrote that question, I think it was more kind of, you know, you ask those questions that are more for yourself than other people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, because like to a certain degree, I kind of feel stuck in a rut. And so just that idea of, well, how do you get out of a rut? Well,
yeah.
You either start climbing up the walls or you stay in it, or, I mean, you can't stop though.
No,
because you can't stop time.
No. And I think for me, I think part of the realization was to be able to say, okay, what's left over? What's the extra lumber that's left over from that last construction project, right? Yeah. And what can I make out of that lumber that takes me someplace else but still builds on what I have? Because being in a rut, sometimes you're in a rut because it's what you know, and you know it really well, mm-hmm. you know, and you're good at it, or, you know, you've been successful at it. So then it's like, well, I don't want to keep doing, like, I didn't feel like I wanted to just make another music documentary, also because it was so expensive to make a music documentary. I didn't want to mm-hmm. be in the position of having to raise tons of money for music rights again. But I did want to do something that was musical, and I did want to do something that was based on what I had just done. And so I was like, yeah, what can I fashion that will feel like a step up instead of staying in that rut? So I think if you can figure out that thing that builds on what you've done, but takes you someplace else, that's the sweet spot.
That's awesome. So you're doing the Musicianer. Mm-hmm. What's, apart from that, what's one big idea that you are just currently obsessed with and chasing?
I do have another documentary project that I'm working on that I think speaks to a lot of what we're talking about today. And it's called Beyond the Duplex Planet. And it's a documentary about someone I've known for almost 40 years now, who is an artist named David Greenberger, who, when we were in our 20s, David did what we now know as a zine. You know, it wasn't necessarily even called a zine then, but he made one of the early zines, which was based on his work as an activities director at a nursing home in a neighborhood in Boston. And David took the unusual step of interviewing these men. It was an all-male nursing home, interviewing these men every month about some theme. But he would ask really bizarre questions. He wouldn't ask, like, you know, where were you during the Second World War, or, you know, tell me about your mother, or, you know, it was stuff like, which do you prefer, coffee or meat, or what do you suppose George Washington's voice sounded like, or what is embarrassment? Like these kinds of questions, which would get people, especially elderly men in various stages of lucidity, would get them stimulated and talking about stuff that wasn't the typical things that people would ask them usually. And they loved the process, and David did this for them initially, but then a lot of us started to get interested in this work, and everyone started reading it. So it became this widely circulated, almost viral publication before that was an option. You know, people subscribed to it and he would send it in the mail. But he still continued with this kind of work to this day. And he travels around the country doing it. And of course, the joke of the film in part is that, you know, he's been talking to senior citizens since he was 20. And guess what? He's about a year away from being an official senior citizen himself, and his subjects look more and more like us all the time. Yeah, so it's a film about aging, but it's also a film about creativity and conversation and how that helps build community, yeah. building community through the arts and building community through conversation. And so it's a tricky film to do because David does interesting things, but you know, trying to find the right dramatic arc for it will be interesting. And I think some of it has to do with his own relationships with his mother, who is also aging, with his own mortality and aging. A film that's going to touch on those things, but it's very open-ended and it's, again, unlike stuff that I usually do.
Yeah.
That's my big thing right now. And it's kind of scary and exciting all at once.
Yeah. I love the sound of that project myself because I have a heart for stories about aging and, you know, just almost to some degree, I feel like we forget about people who are past a certain age as a society. And I don't know, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's I think what David has managed to do all these years is just bring out the humanity in the people he interviews. So it doesn't become about what their actual numerical age is, but who they are as people. He consistently manages to pull that out of people just by his manner and by, you know, his interviewing methods. And it's really something special to see. And he also has taken this material and people have made music albums around it, and he's done live performances, and he's got this cadre of people who really love his work, including Penn and Teller and, you know, various the musicians in REM, and, you know, all these different folks have become fans of David's over the years. So I'm hoping they'll really be able to kind of illuminate what he's managed to do as an artist too. So
that's awesome. Well, Beth, final question for you. This has just been a fantastic conversation, but what's one book and one movie that have both impacted your life?
I think I gave away the movie part already. It's not really a movie, but it's definitely that television series, American Family, that lit something in me that I didn't even get for another 10 years, but it was that excitement of seeing people open up on camera was something that just completely transformed my life. And as far as I've really been thinking hard about the book thing, because that's tricky. You know, there are different ways of looking at it. One is, you know, somebody like Tom Wolfe, who writes nonfiction in the most exciting way, may he rest in peace. You know, like, The Right Stuff was a book that kind of blew my mind about the power of nonfiction storytelling, but done in a really exciting way. And I feel like that's should be the mission of documentary filmmakers, is to be able to approach the truth and still make it appealing and engaging and exciting without having to mess with reality, shall we say. But a book that actually changed my life in terms of an action I took was that I read Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude when I was in college, and then ended up going to Colombia and living in Bogota, Colombia for a while because I wanted to see the place that that author came from. And being open to travel in that way and being able to be somewhere like that was really transforming, and that has served me well over the years, just being flexible as a traveler and flexible in other people's worlds.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. It's been fabulous to know more about your story and just to be inspired with the work that you're doing. Just thank you.
Thank you. It was really fun, Chris. I appreciate it.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It means a lot to me that you do. I really appreciate all the comments that I get throughout the week about how much you are enjoying the monologues and how much you love the interviews. Thank you. It really means a lot to me, and it keeps me wanting to do more and more of this podcast. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to? Drop me a line by sending me an email at chris@chrismartinstudios.com, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at CM Studios. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.